Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today's Friday, December 15th, and I'm very pleased to present to you this audio. It is my recent appearance on Michael Malice's Your Welcome podcast. This was one of the biggest thrills of 2017, a year filled with thrills, I might add. Being invited as a guest, I made the trip down to New York City last week, and through, it was a tremendous experience. I love New York. I love driving into New York. I love driving around New York. I love the people in New York and how fast they move and how cool they talk and how they strut around the city so purposefully. There's a great energy there. I like paying $47 to park in New York City. I'm not even being completely facetious. When you pay almost $50 to park somewhere for 2.5 hours, you really get the sense that you are someplace special. Michael Malice didn't disappoint either. He was an absolutely delightful man in one sense. He made me feel very welcome. You know, I mean, that's kind of his thing with this show. He welcomes people. You're welcome. But he was also very challenging, and I appreciated that as well. In fact, this was our first impression. Little backstory, a little behind the scenes. So I was driving down to Manhattan from the Hartford, Connecticut area, right before the show. Now, I had prepared a nice outfit because this is, you know, you're on camera at Compound Media. That's Anthony Cumia's network, and everything there is video. So I wanted to look presentable. So I had a nice V-neck sweater, a nice collar shirt. I had my nice, sharp car coat, it's called. It's like in between the length of a pea coat and like a full kind of trench coat length. Anybody wearing a coat that long, you should be immediately suspicious of them. So I go for something in the middle. It's called a car coat. You can look it up. And I had a scarf. I was going to show up there looking very sharp. But you don't want to travel in those clothes because you're going to get seatbelt wrinkles on them. This is what I said to myself. So I drive down in a ball cap and a sweatshirt. And I get to the parking garage thinking it will be just like a New Hampshire parking garage where I can leisurely park my own car and then dilly-dally as much as I want around my car, changing my clothes, having privacy. That's not how it works in Midtown Manhattan. You pull into a parking garage, they valet your car, and they're putting a lot of pressure on you to get out of your car and scram. So in all of the melee of that, I forget to change my clothes. And my car disappears with my nice outfit in it. And so I walk into Compound Media in a sweatshirt and a ball cap and a pair of jeans. And I'm feeling rather uncomfortable. And it gets only worse when Michael Malice walks in and he's wearing a suit, which appears to be made out of a very fine twill. And we kind of look each other over. And this is how it begins. I say, "I'm sorry I'm underdressed." I don't make excuses for this. I don't think that's making a good first impression if you immediately start with excuses. I just say, "I'm sorry I'm underdressed." Not that there was any dress code. So yeah, I say, "Sorry I'm underdressed." Michael Malice walks out of the room without saying anything. And then I hear him yell from an adjacent room, somewhat dismissively, "Yeah, we all noticed." And that's how it began. And I, you know, at that point I said, wow, you know, they say never meet your heroes. But I was like, wow, this guy is exactly like he is on Twitter. And I thought that was really neat. But along with these jabs and these challenges, he was very gracious. He was very welcoming. We hung out a little bit after. He was very complimentary about how the show went. He walked me to my car. And remember, this is New York City, so it's not like it was right in front of the building or even anywhere near the building. I was appreciative of that. We talked for a while. And like I said, I look forward to having him on School Sucks in the near future. Now, because he is so fast and so sharp, there were some mishaps on my part, some missed opportunities. I counted four of them. So in the Patreon version of this show, you're going to get an extra commentary track. You'll be able to spot some missed opportunities for explanation and elaboration. There's one part where we're talking about all teachers being awful people. That's his claim. I would have liked to have said more there. Instead, I think I just made a kind of a huffing sound. Perhaps the biggest stumble was when Michael asserted, I think playing a little bit of devil's advocate, that a parent telling a child, because I said so, is actually a valuable lesson for a child. There was obviously a great opportunity there for expansion and for me to challenge him. And that didn't happen. We sped past that part a little bit too quickly. There's another part where we talk about, is school child abuse? That was, listening back to this, the most frustrating moment for me as far as evaluating my performance on the show. There's a lot I would have liked to have said there. And I think there's just another brief moment where he's talking about Christian homeschooling and kids learning, you know, that the earth is 5,000 years old and dinosaurs didn't exist. And that's a problem. And I could have interjected there as well. So in the Patreon version, you'll hear all of that. If you're listening to the regular version, sorry, you'll just have to pull your hair out and yell about what you would have said had you been in that situation. But next time I will be better prepared. So yeah, thank you so much for listening, and thank you to the people in the audience who make trips like this possible. It was the beginning of April when I went to see Tom Woods down at Yale, and I came back and reported to you guys about that experience, and I said, I'm going to do more of this. I'm going to get in my car, I'm going to go places, and I'm going to meet people. And I'm really happy that 8 months and 10,000 driving miles later, I am doing that, and I will continue to do more of it. So that's it. Here's my discussion with Michael Malis. There is more content from School Sucks Across America coming soon. Thank you for listening, and take care.
Good afternoon, I'm Michael Malis. Let that be your welcome for the next hour. You know, every week that goes by, so much happens in the news. I don't know if I'm getting older or if the news cycles are escalating, but we've got Al Franken's on his way out. Sam Cedar was fired from MSNBC after Cernovich kind of left him out to dry. Let me talk a little bit about that. A lot of people are going after Cernovich saying he did the wrong thing. Every prominent news personality, every prominent person who's taking a political stance has people on the other side gunning for them all the time. This is not news. The question is, are you, as the organization MSNBC, going to have your people's back, or are you going to throw them out to the wolves? So if it wouldn't have been Cernovich, it would have been someone else. I mean, they went after Joy and Reid for attacking Charlie Crist, who, you know, I don't even know if the people on the new right who were going after her for calling Charlie Crist Miss Charlie and all that other stuff meant it, or they just want her scalp, because Charlie Crist was pretty outed already. There was a documentary called Outrage, which went through. Oh, I just got that pun. That is so sad. Outrage. Oh, yeah. You know what? It took me literally years. There's a restaurant in there's a chain of them called Calexico. And I just realized today it's a portmanteau of California and Mexico, because I was thinking about Galaga and Calico, because I'm that old. And I'm like, oh, yeah, not a good day for the 160 IQ. Anyway, the point is, Charlie Crist has been outed. Many other people have been outed. So I don't know that they actually really care. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. So it's fun watching the bodies hit the floor. John Nolte on Twitter, who's probably the one person who I'm pissed doesn't follow me back, had this great tweet about, think about, if you think the left is upset now, think about in a week when Al Franken's not in the Senate and Roy Moore is. And, you know, what else is hilarious about Trump being such a chaos engine is, a year ago, if you had Republicans saying they're for Roy Moore, they would have been like, look, this is a hard bullet to bite, but I got to do it. You know what I mean? Blah, blah, blah. Now they're like, you know what? Fuck you. I'm for Roy Moore. And I know he's a fucking pedophile, and I don't fucking care. So I don't know where we go from here, but I love the carnage. I love the mayhem. I love how I'm so nearsighted. I have no idea what it says on that screen. Oh, Mandy. What did she say? Mandy gave me a shout out. Okay, that's pretty cool. Thanks, Mandy. Anyway, let's bring my guest here, who I'm very excited about. Brett Vaynott. Did I pronounce it right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Brett Vaynott. So Brett's from the School Sucks Project. Now, when I first started the show, one of the most flattering and humbling things I always got. See, I don't care what most people think. You don't care what most people think. They're entitled to their opinion. Go live your best life, right?
Right.
And I always thought of myself as someone who goes on to be just an obnoxious asshole and entertaining. And what I realized, and I'm sure you've seen also, many people have never encountered the idea of anarchism as a coherent political philosophy in their lives. They've never heard such a thing. And a lot of these people, when they hear me talk and they hear me give interviews, they're like, oh, this sounds really interesting. Tell me more how it would work. And I'm like, oh shit, you're taking me seriously, which is very flattering, because the number of people who, if I hear their point of view and I'm interested in hearing what they have to say, is very, very small. And then I'm like, well, I can't really explain all this stuff on Twitter and get into it at length. Fortunately, I have my own show. So as I promised my dear readers, I will be bringing people who would explain how not necessarily – you don't have to be an anarchist, but to have alternatives to government programs that can function, that's best for anyone. And the big one that people have the problem with is public education. Because the argument is, if you don't have public education, it's Mad Max. And everyone's killing and raping each other all the time, and they're stupid, unlike now where everyone's really bright and smart.
Exactly, yeah.
So tell me a little bit about the School Sucks Project.
Well, first of all, I mean, it's interesting when they – anytime the left is trying to put a policy in place today, there's – I mean, the subtext of it kind of is, well, everybody's so dumb and helpless. You hear that in the background over and over again. That was the argument 150 years ago now when they set up the system and it solved – none of those problems.
Right.
So I've been doing the show for 8 years. I spent about a decade as a teacher, a tutor, college consultant. A lot of frustration built up during that time. It had nowhere to go. So I started the show just as a way of, you know, turning a vent and letting steam out, because I would have lost my job if I had said anything. Don't go to college. How does that work in the college consulting business?
Right.
That would have been my sincere advice.
So you're familiar with the guys from Praxis, and you must think there's as I do.
Yeah,
Isaac Morehouse, Isaac Slayback. Yeah,
we've worked together a bunch, and I hope we can do more in the future.
Great, great people. Yeah.
So, yeah, I started the show. It picked up some momentum. We built a following. And first 100 episodes just burst out of me because I had so much to say. You know, I'd worked in all these different capacities in education, and I had started to collect all of these awarenesses of problems, right? But it was just a collage. I didn't have a mind map. And when I discovered the ideas of liberty through people like Wes Bertrand, Complete Liberty Podcast, or Stefan Molyneux, familiar with Free Talk Live?
Of course, yes.
Okay, yeah. So they started to turn this into a coherent picture that, you know, maybe it's not a failure. Maybe it's doing a lot of what it's supposed to do as far as indoctrination and standardization is concerned.
Right.
But what are the incentives for it to succeed? You know, unfortunately, there aren't any in public education. So that really put a coherent picture together for me, and I was able to move forward doing my own podcast, you know, with my own voice much more confidently once I understood the ideas of liberty. So it was really a helpful push in the beginning, for sure.
One of the things I always tell people, and I always make pains to say that I'm not joking or trolling, is that I regard public schools as quite literally daytime prisons for children.
Okay.
And that because it's run very frequently by women and gay men, people don't see the fascist subtext. And I genuinely and thoroughly feel that they are there to break the spirits of children, to, first of all, the idea that everyone should be having the same work hours, 9 to 5,
mm-hmm.
may have made sense when you're a fucking farmer and you have to go by the sun. The idea that that should be the case now makes no sense unless it's a function of teaching people obedience and submission to some greater order. So I think that is absolutely psychotic.
You don't think they're complicit in this, though?
Who?
The teachers, these sweet old women and nice gay men. You don't think they're part of a conspiracy? Yeah. You're not saying that, are you?
Is that irony? They're horrible people, as a rule.
Always?
I'm not going to say always, but yes, always. When I came to America, mm-hmm. I from Russia, we had nothing. Right. We had no money. And my parents knew to send me to private school because they knew just how bad public school would be. And they were right. So, but what is it that you see as the problem with public education in a nutshell?
From my 15,000 hours as a student and then all the experience I had in and around the system as an educator, there's three implicit lessons. Number one, you mentioned obedience. Number two, I would say, is conformity. Now, everybody doesn't have to be exactly the same, like in 1984, or wear the same outfit. It's not, you know, to that degree. But everybody gets up at the same time. Everybody right. starts work at the same time. Everybody moves through the same halls. The expectations are very uniform. And I think when you subtly demand this of people, right, there aren't many overt occurrences of, like, do what I say or else. But it's always implied, right, throughout that whole experience. It's just the...
Oh, yes, there is. It's explicitly. For example, one of the things that I...
But is somebody going to say to you, do what I say or
else? Yes, I've been told that.
Maybe five times.
Sure, because that's the five times I've had to defy them. But when I was a kid, you know how it's funny how you think something is some way as a kid, and then as you're an adult, you look back and you're like, oh, I was right on the money.
One of
the things I always resented as a kid, and I still resent, is the idea of homework. So I go to your place, I do the work you want me to do, which I can wrap my head around, and then because you're a fuck up and you can't get your shit done in the hours you've been allotted, I gotta carry your slack at home. That's a big one. And the other big one I couldn't understand is tests. If I'm here to learn and these are things that you have decided are important for me to learn, what possible fucking value is it to me to demonstrate to you, you stupid lady at the front of the room, how well I've learned it? That's that. If I haven't learned it, and this isn't something important to, if I haven't learned how to pay my taxes, if I haven't learned how to drive, I'm the one suffering the consequences, right?
Mm-hmm.
I can't pass the driver's test. If I don't know why dimes were worth more than nickels, I can't make change, things like that.
Right.
I'm the one who's going to suffer the consequences. Yet I have to genuflect and get you to think that I learned this. And then it's at a point now, you got me really triggered, you haven't even said anything, where it's acceptable and encouraged for parents to help kids with their homework, which makes even less sense to me. Because the whole point of the homework is I'm doing it and I'm showing it and I learned it.
This could go in so many different directions because there you have this wedge into the family, right? Where parents, I mean, it was certainly the case in my household, unfortunately, parents become police for the school.
Right.
You know, and that fractures the one of the most important relationships that, you know, especially as far as education and, you know, gaining wisdom is concerned, the relationships that kids have with adults. So, you know, when I was working in these schools, I thought I was cool. You know, I remember I'd get into a fight with my dad when I was 16 years old, and I'd say, when I'm 40, I'm going to be cool. I started working with kids when I was 21, like 2001, around there. I was like, wow, I'm already not cool. You know? But what was the point there?
The wedge in the family.
The wedge in the family. So I wanted to be this cool guy, but I fit a kind of archetype for these kids. You're just another one of these shithead adults
right.
who's going to tell me what to do. So even when I moved from teaching into like private services, tutoring and college consulting, I would still often be met with that, you know, arm's length standoffishness from a lot of these kids. I just went on a tour. It was called School Sucks Across America, 40 days. And we went to a lot of like alternative schools. And one thing that was really striking, we were in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. We went to this place called the Circle School. All these teenagers, two strange adults walk in to get a tour. They all come up. They introduce themselves because they haven't been put into that setting where they have to have an antagonistic relationship or at least like avoid adults kind of a relationship. So they say, hey, I interact positively with adults all the time as I freely choose what my education is. Here's new adults. I'm going to go see what they're all about. But school doesn't do that. It doesn't do that with the teachers. And I mean, I had a couple of teachers who I thought were cool, who I didn't think were terrible people. But my attitude towards adults and towards my own parents was definitely damaged.
Tell me a little bit. You were saying how this was their goal 150 years ago. Tell me how the idea of public education came about and what their agenda was.
It was a confluence of interests that started to come together in Central Europe around the early 1800s in what is today Germany. So the Kingdom of Prussia had a problem, because this was before everyone bought into nationalism.
Right.
So they had this problem that I think they refer to as fire discipline with their military, where people would shoot at guys, and the guys would do the sensible thing and kind of like flee the area
right,
instead
right.
of shooting back and marching forward. the administrative state there set up a tiered education system with a primary goal of improving fire discipline, but also kind of preparing the population to be efficient and compliant in an emerging industrial economy. So they had a tiered school system that started what was called the Volksschule, people's school, and then they had a central level, which was called the Realschule, which actually meant real school, like where they taught the management class.
Okay.
And then above that, I think it was called Akademienschulen, which was for the masters of the society, like the top 1%. So 90%+ went to the Volksschule, the people's school. In the middle of the 1800s, Americans, Brits, Frenchmen, they started touring around and filing what were called traveler's reports. At that time, especially in the United States, a lot of Central European economies were very competitive with the United States, and people in the United States, especially in this like emerging academic and educational, it was very religious focused too. People who wanted to become the scientific managers, they were looking to Central Europe to say, well, what are they doing right? And one of the things that people like Horace Mann, the father of American public education, decided was it was their schools. So the traveler's reports would be like, yeah, this is really authoritarian, Mann's traveler's report, but we could certainly bring it here and use it to forward our republican institutions. And Mann, who was there in the 1850s, he never even saw the schools in session, but that was good enough. He interviewed some schoolmasters and some teachers, and they started to implement the public system, like right out of Prussia, into Massachusetts. And then once it was set up there, it caught on like wildfire because the political class saw the potential of it to teach those three lessons, right? Obedience, conformity. And I never even got to the third one, which obviously didn't stick with you, but it's like, you know, if people don't really consciously experience those things, I was trained in obedience, I was trained in conformity. The result is, okay, well, other people will tell me what to do, and my top priority, like socially, is fitting in. The third lesson, as the result of those first two, is a kind of intellectual and philosophical apathy.
Oh, yeah.
And that explains a lot of the adult world you and I live in.
Yeah. I mean, if you're a critical thinker, the odds of you being a school teacher are quite low because the bar to get that job is so low, you're gonna be at the top 10% automatically. So you're gonna be doing something else.
Right.
So it's a job where, and in the defense of teachers, they have these lesson plans that are from bureaucracies that decide what they have to teach, and in a sense they have to.
Right.
So their hands are tied in that sense as well.
Yeah, and I did with that. I did derail the history a little bit. Mann and all of that educational elite in 19th century America, I think their primary goals, and this was like the first phase of setting up school, was standardization and homogenization of the public. The writing is on the wall as far as slavery is concerned. That's going to be a lot of free people who need to be managed somehow.
Right.
And you also have this first wave of immigration that's starting to happen. And that certainly scared, as it still does today, scared a lot of people that, you know, people would be speaking other languages and having other cultures. And they needed the school to be a kind of forge, you know, that people would come out the other side of and be predictable and governable. And they wouldn't have been. I mean, you've read Thaddeus Russell's Renegade History, right?
Of course, he's been on the show, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So he talks about the stories of these, you know, Irish immigrants. It's almost like it kind of humanizes the people who wanted to be the scientific managers when you look at what they were trying to manage,
right.
You know? I mean, not to take sides, but just to tell a more complete history. If you've got a bunch of Irish immigrants who you've tasked with building a bridge and they get drunk all day and throw bottles at each other and then you won't pay them, so they blow up the bridge.
Right.
Yeah, that's a management problem to be solved for sure. So that was the original impulse. But once the schools were established, so many different interests, including, you know, like everyone from the Ku Klux Klan to the United Nations over the course of a century, understood the potential that the schools have to produce a product desirable to a managerial class. So it's gone through a number of phases, but that was the first: homogenization, standardization. And then in that same phase, I would also say you got industrialization, where people like the Rockefellers, the Rockefeller Education Board was a huge force in American public schooling and set up at the beginning of the 1900s. As they started to reform the system, people like John Dewey, who you're probably familiar with at Columbia University, Dewey had very lofty kind of utopian socialist ambitions for what the schools could produce. And I think industrialists like the Rockefellers looked at that and said, oh, you're trying to figure out how to get everybody to do what you want? Well, here's some money. Let us know what you find out, right. You know, because we can use that, too, for our own reasons. So a lot of the Columbia shaping of public education projects were actually funded by industrialists in the early 1900s.
Yeah. There's a new book out that I haven't read by Rothbard's and called The Progressive Era.
Really?
Yeah, it just came out last month from his notes. So, and one of his big points is, and again, I haven't read it. This is from reading the Dust Jacket. So obviously I'm prepared to teach a college course on the subject. No, but one of his points is the Progressive Era was very much a collaboration between these starry-eyed progressive thinkers and corporate America. Mm. And they got together and they're like, all right, we've got the money, you've got the ideas. How do we turn the country into a giant corporation that's going to work for everyone and no one's going to drink or have fun? And they're just going to be, quote unquote, productive citizens who are hardworking and have no humanity to them whatsoever.
Yeah, that kind of asceticism. And it's there from the beginning. So it's interesting that it kind of moves from, you know, the Unitarian religious crowd like Horace Mann and his friends right into the Progressive Era. Lots of horrible ideas there. I mean, that's where eugenics comes from. Behaviorism, almost to a degree of like psychological experimentation.
Yes.
That begins in the 1940s, the 1950s. Universities are being funded to do research. I'd say that's the third phase. And then, you know, the fourth phase is globalization, producing global citizens.
Well, what else is insane is it from an early age. See, what I didn't have a great upbringing. I don't know about yours. But when you're growing up, you assume that your upbringing is the universal and the norm. Mm. And only as an adult are you like, okay, this was a function of my particular family or the city I grew up in or my country and so on and so forth.
Right.
With public school, one of the things you subconsciously accept as the norm is the idea that you're going to be stuck with this other group of people, your fellow classmates, for a year, and you have to get along with them. Whereas in real life, you can quit your job. You don't have to associate with anyone that you don't want to. And even at work, it's not going to be the same 40. People are going to be coming and going. You could switch departments. You can look for a new job, so on and so forth. And that, I think, is a very useful thing for corporate America, especially factory America, the idea that you and your job are not separable.
Mm-hmm.
You and your coworkers are not separable. And that basically getting fired or quitting is unconscionable. That this should be your life is what you've been assigned to.
It's what you've been trained for.
Yeah.
Right. So you had a guest. I was listening to some of your recent episodes to prep for this. And you had a guest, Luis J. Gomez.
Yes.
And you guys
That's
were talking
right.
about peaceful parenting.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a real libertarian angle to peaceful parenting. I mean, it's not like parents can just say, I'm going to raise my kids like this, and then they'll certainly turn out like that.
Sure.
But Stefan Molyneux used to make the point, because he was he really turned up the volume on peaceful parenting years
right.
ago and not spanking. You know, he would say that if you're not doing this, the term is a problem, right? Because it's implied that if you're not a peaceful parent, you're what? A violent parent?
So that is the implication.
I think the language could use work, but the ideas, especially as Lewis presented them, I thought he did a fantastic job like outlining what it is. But what Steph added to that is you're teaching children to speak the language of the state. Right. So if you are raised in those formative years in a very authoritarian environment, like it sounds like you were to a certain extent, or you were inside this container of a very authoritarian culture that came with your family to.
No,
you know?
I don't know. It was it was more they were strict and kind of had their look, there was a book written about me. It's a whole Megillah, but it's not that. It wasn't like, you know, Chinese dragon mom kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
But it was very much a like high expectations thing, which wasn't necessarily a bad thing. And I was very fortunate to go to private school because I was trilingual by the time I was in first grade, which I think had an enormously positive effect on my cognitive faculties.
Right. I just asked because I saw that you were a little you had some skepticism about the
I'll tell you why I have skepticism of peaceful parenting.
Sure.
On the train right here, I saw the following three people. First, there was a guy who got on at Canal Street,
mm-hmm.
Junkie guy type, that crusty look, who was playing Wonderwall on his guitar for money, and he couldn't sing. Then At the other, I switched trains, and a guy was standing, a suit, leaning on the pole, checking his phone. That, on a crowded train, that pole is for holding. You shouldn't have to be told, hold the pole and get off it. Then, as we're waiting for the door to exit, someone's standing by the door whistling like a fucking canary. I perfectly would feel comfortable taking a lead pipe to all these three people and bludgeoning them till their heads pop open.
Why not?
Especially the second one, I can get a key apologize. But the first and third, absolutely.
Okay.
So, to me, when you're dealing with stupid people, and children are, by definition, ignorant, right? They don't know what the hell's going on. None of us did. You can't.
They're just not self-aware. They're not aware of how they affect their surroundings.
Of course.
Exactly what you're describing on the trains. Yeah.
Right. At a certain point, it's just like, you know what? I find it very hard to believe that just once the back of your hand across their face isn't a lesson that, just like your hand on the stove, just once is a lesson you need to learn.
The hand on the stove can be a hand on the stove. You know, a lot of the parents that I've seen, their kids are exposed to situations that a lot of other parents, like overprotective, the hover helicopter parents, bubble wrapping their kids, they would say, oh, you shouldn't do that. As long as the kid's not going to get killed or kill somebody else, it's like it's not a bad idea for them to learn cause and effect early.
Sure.
You know, I think that's fine. And I think that peaceful parenting, I'm not saying you're doing this, but people might conflate it with like permissive or the 11th place ribbon parenting.
Oh, yes,
like everything you do is magical and wonderful.
No punishments.
I don't think it has to come with that. I think it's just the resistance of a parent saying things like, because I said so. Right. When a kid does the thing that earns because I said so, the kid is saying, hey, I'm being self-assertive and I'm expressing curiosity. And the parent is saying, shut the fuck up.
Right.
You know, so what kind of lesson is that?
That's an important lesson, which is people in power are not going to justify themselves to you, and they often don't have to.
I agree that that's a lesson that should be learned. I'm not sure that it has to be learned right there. I just think that if that is the mode of parenting, when kids go to school, they're not going to have the experience in school that you had where you're like, this is bullshit. They're going to say, oh, this place makes perfect sense. This is
that
exactly
was my
how
experience.
I'm treated at home.
I was told at home because I said so. And then when I went to school, I thought this was bullshit because my dad was very, very
bright.
That's
a very unique experience. I don't think a lot of people
by definition,
that.
My life is going to be unique.
Yeah, sure. But very out of the norm. I think if they're treated like that at home, the school environment would then make sense. It would then go on and on and on without question.
That's fair.
You know, and then what comes after that? The state, citizenship.
But see, if you're positioning this in terms of to be against public education means having to hate the government, most people will write you off as a lunatic.
Of course. Yeah.
So my point is this has nothing – just like – okay. Arguing about who's going to build roads, right? Mm-hmm. If you have Easy Pass in your car – right, it's an electronic device that pays the tolls automatically, right? And you say, look, if you have this Easy Pass and you go on these roads, it's going to be cheaper. You don't have to understand private roads. All you have to understand is I go on this road, it's cheaper, right?
Exactly.
So if you're teaching about public education, all from my in my opinion, it's nothing to do with politics necessarily. All it has to do with is your kids are getting screwed up by the system and there's better alternatives and you could still vote for Hillary as much as you want.
But you're still going to deal with, even if you don't make it necessarily political, you're still going to deal with a tremendous amount of cognitive dissonance because people have talked to me when I've talked not so much about the tax side of it or everyone's forced to pay for this, so of course it would suck. It more about like what are the outcomes for kids? When I take it from that side, you think that would be a better way to connect with people, but the cognitive dissonance is very powerful in those cases. They say, look, I have a mortgage. I have a job that I don't like. I have a boss that I'm not crazy about. I have a marriage that isn't easy to maintain. I have a car that I have to bring
in. And yet
they'll
defend.
Like, this thing is free, right? This is my Easy Pass.
But they'll defend that life to the death. I hate my job. I hate my wife. I hate my car. I hate my house. But God damn you for trying to take this away from me.
No, I'm not even saying that. It's just like they're
serious, though.
These are things that are a lot of work. These are things that require a lot of my time and attention. I have this Easy Pass set up called public education that's going to not only babysit my child for 35 hours a week, but it's also fairly easy for me to pretend that they're learning something there.
Well, it's also the thing that I've always told – I have a lot of friends who are atheists, which they can be annoying about it.
Sure.
And my point to them is it's a lot easier to believe that a virgin gave birth to Christ and all that other stuff than that literally everyone you know is suffering from some crazy delusion.
Right.
It's a lot easier. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot easier to think that public education has some problems, but, you know, so does everything, as opposed to I'm sending my child into this building every day where he is going to be broken. And the point is to break him. The point of public education, which is making good citizens, is a very nice way of saying we're going to break you down and rebuild you in our image, just like in the army. But you get to leave the army.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. 70, 80, 90 years ago, when people were writing books that they didn't know people would be able to find someday, they were very explicit about this. You know, they talked about children as lumps of clay that needed to be reshaped.
Right.
Kids were called retarded.
Have you seen those kids? They're also ugly.
Kids? Like little kids?
Yeah, out there. It's full of the retardeds. I mean, everywhere you go.
Retarded, ugly. So what do we do with all these retarded, ugly kids?
Well, I don't know. That's a you problem. I just have my show. You're the one trying to fix this situation.
Nope. Because that's the dodge that people do a lot with me when people are supportive of the system. They'll say, well, what would you do?
Yeah, what would you do?
What would I do with 160 million of other people's kids? What kind of psycho would try to answer a question like that? So let's just use a metaphor. If I was like a health coach,
sure,
and I said, eat clean, natural food, and you know where it came from. If somebody said to me, well, no, tell me what you would do about factory farming and GMOs. I don't know. We're not talking about that. You know, we're talking about like what individuals can do to be better nourished physically. And, you know, what I talk about on my show is what individuals can do to break away from that and be better nourished intellectually. I honestly don't care what happens to most people. Do you feel an obligation to, you know, care about what happens to all of these people that you pass on your way here every day?
I have an obligation that if I'm going to say public school is the devil and should be abolished, to have some sort of alternative.
I don't even say it should be abolished. I mean, I did in the beginning. I was very naive about that. But it's going to go on as long as the state goes on. It is a golden egg-laying goose of obedience and conformity and manageability. And, you know, I have to kind of make a personal assessment. Am I going to fight against that? How small and insignificant and ineffective am I going to feel as I go on that crusade? Meanwhile, I could do the opposite, which is operate inside my own sphere of control, where I can attract an audience to me and I can say, hey, here's some resources that I found helpful. I'm only an expert on so many things. I exceeded my expertise on the show in like 2011. And then I had to start bringing in other people who say, hey, you know, here's the philosophy of Stoicism. Here's the philosophy of Objectivism. Here's Nathaniel Brandon's 6 pillars of self-esteem. You know, take what you want and leave the rest behind. Take what's helpful and leave the rest behind. And that's what we try to do. I don't have any design on reforming the public education system. I think that's a treadmill that people get on. I've seen those people. You know, my dad was chairman of the school board when I was growing up. They wanted to run him out of town with torches because he suggested that teachers' pay should be merit-based. That was his radical reform.
Right.
People should get paid based on how good they are at their job. You know, so I don't think that there's any saving the public education system. I think there's saving individuals within it if they want to be saved and they
so
want to take that ownership over themselves.
If I'm a parent who has realized, wait a minute, there's got to be a better way than this,
mm-hmm.
What options do I have if I'm not rich?
Okay, so how would you feel about taking your kids out and letting them educate themselves? Like just in this example, how does that idea strike you?
Well, I mean, in your experience, is that an idea that people are receptive to?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Home education or unschooling? Indeed.
Yeah, what is unschooling?
Unschooling is letting children learn the way adults learn. They decide what they're interested in. They kind of ride on their intrinsic motivation into learning about that thing. They experience satisfaction of mastery or close to mastery of some new thing. And then that satisfaction spills into other areas.
But does that mean none of the girls ever learn math?
It might.
Okay.
So what are the consequences of that?
Well, then how are you going to go to college, for example? So you're saying, what I'm saying is if you're at a point where you, as a kid, you don't learn certain things,
mm-hmm.
to not have that door open for you to college, that's a big door to close in kindergarten. That's like allowing that 5-year-old to determine his gender.
Okay, so why is the door closing in kindergarten, though?
Because if you're if they're unschooled, right, mm-hmm. and they are only learning the subjects that they find interesting, and if they, for example, never find math interesting or never find science interesting, there's going to be at some point some mandatory math classes, and it's going to be higher. It's going to be algebra and calculus. It's not going to be, you know, the times tables.
Right. But what I'm saying is I don't think they would have to learn about that on the school's timetable. You know, people have written me a lot of messages and said, look, my son is 7 and he's not reading. You're using the school's timetable. He might not want to read until he's 9. I mean, you have to learn to read to learn other things.
Correct.
Right? And you have to learn basic arithmetic for
right.
lots of things that you would want to learn if they were scientific or musical.
Sure.
So if the momentum, the intrinsic motivation creates a momentum, it will push through that. I see this all the time working with, or I used to, I don't do this kind of work anymore, but kids would have some kind of passion. They would have some kind of goal. They would learn the things they needed to learn along the way to achieve that.
But that's almost circular reasoning, because if I don't know something, I don't know what I don't know and what I need to know.
All right. So let's just say a kid wants to learn about astronomy.
Right.
Okay. So what I saw in working with somebody this age is that they reach a block. They say, there's something I don't know. And then it's a question of like, well, do you still want to learn about astronomy? How do you move that block? I think that guidance is important.
Okay.
I think there is such a thing as like unparenting. So maybe I could explain this a little bit better. A parent needs to create an educational environment. I think that is a parental responsibility. And I think they either need to be an educational mentor or they need to find other people who can be. And I've been hired to do that. If a parent didn't know about a certain subject, they said, can you at least be a guide? You know, you can let Chris take the lead. But, you know, when he runs into frustrations or obstacles, can you at least show him the map?
Yeah, but I mean, that's kind of a hands-off tutoring situation.
That was a lot of what I did.
Yeah. But what happens to these kids? Don't they grow up? I mean, this is the big argument also, is don't they grow up all weird and warped because they don't have any kind of, they don't form friendship relationships?
Why wouldn't they form friendship relationships?
Well, what are they doing during the day if they're not going to school?
A lot of these people are really well networked. There's homeschool communities. I mean,
okay.
I was in, where was I? Wichita, Kansas, at a gathering with like 30 people, you know, a handful of parents. And then everybody else there was kids close together in age, but not exactly the same age like they would be in school. They were all playing with each other. They meet every week. This happens everywhere. And it's almost impossible to not have these networks today with the internet. You know, I understand that, yeah, homeschooling, the stigma around homeschooling 20 years ago was just some real weirdos.
Yeah.
Who were doing this, really isolating their kids.
Right.
You just people just picture the kitchen table with a stack of school books. Right. What would be the point of that? So I don't even like the term homeschooling. I don't like anything that has school in it. Let school do school. I like home education or real world education or like being immersed in the adult world education. You know, it's back to what I was saying about kids have these antagonistic relationships with adults. Adults are great teachers, even if they're not called teachers. You know, I'm not called a teacher. You're not called a teacher. How many people are learning from what we do?
Right.
More than they would be learning if they were stuck in a public school. So giving kids the freedom. So homeschooling is like two problems, right? Home is claustrophobic.
Right.
And schooling is you picture you're working on a timetable. There's going to be reports. There's expectations for you at 7 years old, 8 years old, 9 years old. That's none of all that stuff has to be thrown out, I think. These parents let their kids out into the real world and they build organized networks. So there's socialization. And then, I mean, the other side of that is you'd have to make the argument, if you're playing devil's advocate, you'd have to make the argument that what's happening in public schools is in any way positive socialization.
There aren't many positive aspects to socialization in public school. I've made great friends that I'm still friends with.
But you couldn't only make them in school, and there's
Correct,
some negative aspects.
But I did make them in school, so that is a positive.
Sure. You entered public school what? You were in elementary school?
Fourth grade, yeah.
Okay, so when you walked in there and you started to observe your surroundings, did you regard that as like a socially positive and helpful situation
for you? In fourth grade, they couldn't send me to the magnet program right away because mm-hmm. I was transferring in halfway through the year from private. So they sent me to Gen Pop, and it was mortifying in many ways. I will never forget it. I was by far the smartest kids, and I'd never met dumb kids before. Because at Yeshiva, we were kind of stratified based on your achievement level.
Sure. Yeah.
So after fourth grade, they sent me to this, you know, the smart kid class and whatever, and so on and so forth. But yeah, it was not a good time. It must have been only like five months, but I look back on it with great disdain, which kind of speaks to my snobbery, which has remained to this day. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was terrible.
Yeah.
But then I mean, these were what happens when you have all these terrible kids? I mean, what do you do with them? The problem is you also have lots of people who shouldn't be having kids to begin with.
Of course. Right. I want to make sure that I'm answering your question before do you feel unsatisfied with what I'm saying?
For example, my friends' parents, I have friends who have kids and they're homeschooling, mm-hmm. right? And I saw these, here's the other big knock. I saw these textbooks and they're like creationist textbooks. And there's a book about biology and
cartoon, yeah.
No scientist has ever seen a fish walk out of the water. So evolution is just a theory. Meanwhile, we know God's awesome and that he made these two butterflies that look like each other so that they can warn predators of poison.
Okay, well, I'm not an extremist here. Those kids might be better off in a public school, you know, if that's the science curriculum at home. You know?
Well, I don't know that they'd be better off per se in a public school, but what I'm saying is how do you work around that?
I don't know.
Okay.
So I have a niche with my show where I try to attract these people who are dissatisfied with this system and looking for alternatives, and I try to provide them alternatives. And if it just meant going across the country to find them and interview people and hear what people were doing in their homes. But I really, I want to stress that I have no hope for the system as a whole. I think that, like I said, the schools will exist as long as the state exists.
Do you think parents sending these kids to public schools, particularly some of the worst public schools, is basically a form of child abuse?
I don't see how that language is helpful.
That's not what I asked you.
No.
I'm not interested in helping people. You just yourself said you had no obligation. I don't have an obligation to be helpful. So let's hear the answer.
All right.
I'm not here to help people.
So
I'm here to welcome people.
I think that child abuse...
That was the most corporate answer I've ever had on this show. And I've had Mitt Romney.
See how this is helpful.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's actually the most school teacher answer I've ever had.
You're
not helping.
I don't know if that's the right phrase, child abuse. I think it's negligence.
Negligence is child abuse.
Okay. Then you back me into child abuse.
Okay. Okay. So the alternatives are unschooling.
Unschooling. That may or may not involve, depending on the age of the child and the aptitude of a child, a guided tutoring kind of relationship. But there's lots of schools that are set up around that same model using a kid's intrinsic motivation, which is really
the Montessori method?
Montessori starts that way. And I actually just found out on this trip that Montessori goes all the way up through high school.
Yeah.
I always just thought of it as, you know, a sort of pre-K through K school. But another model is Sudbury.
Okay, what's that?
Sudbury started in Massachusetts. It's a school environment, so it's a place where a bunch of resources are pooled together. There are adult staff who work as guides, and the kids come in and they pick what they want to learn about, and then they pursue that. And Sudbury's existed since the 1970s. They've had pretty good results as far as people being able to be placed in jobs or attend college. If they decide, I mean, when do you need to start getting ready for college? 12 years old, if you decide you want to go to college. I don't think it's something that has to start when you're like 6 or 7 years old. So there would be an advisor who would say, okay, if you want to be on a college track, this would be the expectation of you by the time you turn 17 years old. There's lots of schools that use the Sudbury model but are not called Sudbury schools. The school that I was telling you about where the social teens came up to me.
Circle School.
It was a circle school in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
It's a very, very weird name, the Circle School. What does that mean?
That's a good question, why it's called that.
It sounds ominous to me.
The Greeks had this idea.
It sounds like the squares are punished.
The Greeks had this idea, encyclios paideia. Have you ever heard that word?
No.
It's where our word encyclopedia comes from, and it basically means a closed education. Pretty synonymous with the public school experience that we'll call this education, but in many ways it's kind of counterfeiting, right? That idea that people are being told this is learning and how dangerous that is. And if you look at a lot of the college kids today and the ideas they're promoting, they think they're pretty damn smart, right? So there's something very, what's the quote? A little learning is a dangerous thing?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's that idea that you're told that you were educated if you went through these 15,000 hours, right?
Right.
And what attitudes did you form about learning and the work that comes with learning in that time? Pain, boredom, purposelessness, So what kind of attitude extends into your adult life about furthering your education?
And also this expectation, if I do as I'm told, I'm going to be rewarded and not have to worry.
Yeah, that's a whole other dynamic of it. Yeah,
here's,
sure.
But here's another big criticism I think I have of what you're arguing for, which kind of makes sense to me. When a lot of my, you know, I have a lot of people, I'm writing a book on the New Right and these kind of alt-right types. If you look at like poor black kids act in public school and then you see how they act in magnet schools and these other schools, it's night and day. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're a joy. So isn't there a big case to be made that schooling can take kids who come from really fucked up families and actually that is the one place where they're safe and allowed to thrive?
You're talking about like charter programs?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's an experiment that I'm willing to see, you know. There's an unfortunate problem with charter schools now that there's kind of like a lot of fly-by-night operations. It's very
right.
easy to get considered a charter school. But I do like the charter experiment. I used to be much more of a purist about this and say, well, if you know, they have these vouchers that parents can use to, you know, send their kid from the bad public school to the good charter school. The unions are going to swarm in on that eventually and say, well, this is public money. This is our money.
Right, right.
So the teachers in those schools need to be under our view, right? And that hasn't happened yet. So I'm not saying that there hasn't been attempts, but I would really like to see a quantitative study of like where kids are going from charter schools and what makes good charter schools. I think it's at least an intermediate kind of step between where we are and where I'd like to be. And when I was much more of a purist, I didn't like intermediate steps.
Right.
I wanted everybody to do, like, kids can teach themselves and everybody needs to do that. Most people aren't going to do that. And some kids might not be set up to teach themselves, especially after they have to decompress coming out of public school. You know, I mean, that's a process that could take years.
What about this argument, which makes some sense, that mm-hmm. when you have these vouchers in these charter schools, you're cherry picking the kids whose parents actually give a fuck about them, right? And they're going to the charter school, and what you're left behind are children who are the most vulnerable, who have no one at home to take care of them.
Yeah.
And now you don't have the resource of public school. And by the time they're five, they're fucked for life.
Yeah, absolutely. And for those kids, because I used to work with populations of kids like that, I was my first teaching job was in a boarding school in Vermont, and we pulled our entire population came from, you know, inner city Baltimore, Washington, D.C. Yeah, school was a kind of respite for those kids. I mean, they didn't behave or succeed there and often got kicked out, which is how they came to the place that I work. But I totally understand that argument. I don't see how any of the, you know, the political class that's been meddling in those communities for a century now and only making them worse can go in there and, you know, start any kind of intervention that's going to make that situation better. The leadership has to come from within those communities to change those situations. The government doesn't have any solution to that problem. And it's sad. I mean, especially seeing it firsthand, it was heartbreaking. And in a way, as like a citizen, it's scary,
right?
You know, that you see this problem just getting worse and worse.
When you can see that 5-year-old, you know you are going to be a killer, mm-hmm. in jail or dead by the time you're 20.
Yeah, and so in the recent discourse, there's like a real racial component to this conversation, but that never really resonated with me because the school that I worked at, we took kids from these inner city populations. Yeah, they were all black, but we also took kids from poor rural Vermont, and they were all white. And all those kids had exactly the same set of problems, you know, or very, very similar sets of problems, very, very similar ways of acting out those problems, right? So it had a lot to do with where they came from as far as their family, but also the communities that surrounded them and the attitudes in those communities towards things like education or self-improvement or escaping those communities.
Yes.
There's a lot of hostility to somebody making good.
Getting the ghetto pass.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's the same thing in the trailer parks in New England.
So let's talk – but then as an educator, if you're being for this peaceful parenting and these kids are being completely violent and out of control, what are you supposed to do?
Give me a more specific example.
What I'm saying is you have a classroom and the kid – or whatever the situation was in that boarding school, right?
Right?
And the kid – there are kids who are, I'm sure the vast majority of them were disruptive.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not allowed to hit them, or what are you supposed to do with them?
Oh, that's an interesting question because we were allowed to put our hands on them.
Well, I mean, because they're probably hitting you.
Yeah,
I mean, if they're coming from the absolute inner city, I'm sure that at least some of them are going to be hitting you.
Oh, absolutely. I remember pulling this one kid off one of my teacher's aides. He had two handfuls of her hair.
Yeah.
You know, and I had to physically restrain him. These kids were sedated. You know, I mean, once they go into state custody, they're on Medicaid. And there's really, unfortunately, some cozy relationships between, you know, the pharmaceutical industry and Medicaid. So a lot of these kids who get this money for insurance that no one is being a very good steward of, they wind up on lots of drugs that, you know, haven't been tested on kids that age. So that, I mean, that was, I was a lefty when I worked there. And, you know, so this was like 2000 to 2004. And I said, oh, this is how kids in state custody get treated. But you put me in an interesting position there, because nobody ever asked me to like line up those two experiences of that actual mayhem
right
I was in the middle of, and these ideals, right? And you know, I only talk about peaceful parenting as like, hey, something that you parents should look into. And one of the things that I would want to prevent is the because I said so
right
model of authoritarian parenting right. or disinterested parenting or annoyance parenting, where I see a lot of that, where parents are just annoyed by their own kids, you know, as almost like the default. But you're right. By the time, I mean, these kids that I was working with, 14, 15 years old.
Oh, at that age, forget it.
Yeah. There was no, I mean.
They would look at you as weak and as prey. I'm Russian, so I know the mentality.
No, you're absolutely right. And we would run therapeutic groups. You know, I was involved with the clinical side of the school. So we would have discussion groups with these kids. And it wasn't, you know, a constant fist fight, throwing chairs, people getting stabbed with butter knives. But when things got out of hand, they got out of hand. And, you know, it's really sad. But the momentum in those kids' lives is to such an extent that I didn't really think the school was terribly therapeutic. Number one, because of the drugs. Number two, because of the physical interventions.
Yeah.
Number three, because they didn't do the best job of screening the staff. It wasn't like they had a hard time keeping good employees there. As a
who would want to work there?
Exactly. Well, so, I mean, they would say, hey, we'll pay you $9 an hour. So this is, you know, late 90s, early 2000s in Bennington, Vermont,
right,
where there's no economy. There's just a bunch of boarded up old factories. We'll pay you $9 an hour to come and work at this school. That was pretty. I was in college at the time. $9 an hour was pretty sweet.
But they couldn't pay someone $1,000 an hour to work at a place like that.
No, I mean, people would do it. We'd get used to it. We'd know what to do. The first week was insane. It was terrifying.
Right.
But they were always fully staffed.
Okay.
And a lot of us, you know, we were young and idealistic just out of college, like the people teaching in these schools. We learned in college that we owed it to the world, that we had to give back. You know, I was very liberal, like I said, so I brought this idealism to that job, and it just evaporated there within a year or two. So the high burnout is they'd attract a lot of young, energetic people like myself and my coworkers, but within a couple of years, we'd want nothing to do with that place anymore. Be ready to move on to something else. I mean, my move from there was to go to a private school where I taught history for a couple of years, which was, you know, no hands-on. Kids were there voluntarily, no meds. And then I went to work with, like, the overachievers in Boston.
Do you have any advice for parents who are of the mind that what they can do to make the public school education system better for their own kids, like working within the system? There's got to be some things that mechanism that they have.
I think the best thing they can do, and this is not an answer to your exact question, is that they have to see themselves and they have to see their kids as the two primary educational forces
okay. In
the life of that child, right? So, you know, I talked to somebody in the Midwest who was really distraught because she had done home education with her kids and then she got divorced. And her spiteful husband says, guess what? Now the kids are going to public school. And she was really upset about that. And I said to her, one benefit of this is that you at least took matters into your own hands at home. I mean, we went through school. So many of us go through school like it's this tube.
Yes.
You know, there's no way to go back. There's no way out. And then somewhere at the end, there's this sparkle of satisfaction or happiness or worthiness or employability. And these kids who weren't put in that tube at 5 years old, her kids might have been like, you know, 11, 12 at this point, they look at it like this vista, you know? It's like the difference between going through, what's the tunnel that's under us, the Lincoln Tunnel?
Yeah.
And flying over the city in a helicopter. those kids went out when they were 5 years old and they interacted with adults,
you know,
apprenticed with blacksmiths.
We're almost out of time, and I thought this would be the first time that I'd have a libertarian on the show who doesn't mention helicopters, and yet here we are.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And they can throw communists out of them if they want. It's they're free, Mike.
We shouldn't make jokes like that. It's very inappropriate.
I agree.
Yeah, it's like Hitler.
Edit that part out.
Yes. Yeah. Cut, Gary. Can you cut that from the podcast? Let's just rewind. So, it must be though very rewarding for you because when even if you talk to one parent and you save that one kid, that's a you could pat yourself on the back for that. To yeah. save one fucking life. That's a big deal.
Well, that was actually one of the reasons why I went on this tour. Thaddeus Russell and I had done these events the weekend with Thaddeus Russell. School Sucks and Renegade University present a weekend with Thaddeus Russell. People came. We put them on the mics. They told us
you know he's not verified on Twitter.
What?
Hey, Thaddeus.
He told us these great stories about how, you know, his show or my show had affected their lives. There was this kid, Alex, who came to the event that we did in Salem, Massachusetts. He said, it's because the school sucks that I didn't go to college. And now I run this successful marketing business.
Wow.
It's an awesome story.
Yeah.
You know, and now he's making money while his peers are still going deeper into debt.
And has self-esteem because he made it by himself at
Absolutely.
A young age.
So any stories like that that I can collect, or, you know, that really motivates me. And I found myself sitting at home. By myself a lot of the time, looking at the world through this monitor, you know, that's only showing me the worst shit, only showing me stuff to agitate me.
Typical libertarian. All I have is the monitor.
Well, I'm pretty good about avoiding that. But I felt like, you know, in the middle of 2017, I was really sucked into it. And I said, I'm letting all my attention be drawn into this area where I have no control. This is out of my sphere of control. Meanwhile, I'm running this thing that's affected all these people. I'm going to get in my car and go meet them, you know? So that's why I originally was going to come here, the day before Thanksgiving? I'm so glad I didn't do that. I was a wreck.
Why were you a wreck? Oh, because the whole traveling?
Well, I've been on the road for 40 days, but it's also like, you know,
Moses.
11 hours from Richmond, Virginia to Brooklyn.
Jesus. Is it 11?
No, it's no, six. It's six.
Yeah.
But the day before Thanksgiving, it's 11.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm glad we didn't do it that day.
Well, we're out of time as always, for fuck's sake. Please check out schoolsucksproject.com.
I made a page for your listeners. So go to schoolsucksproject.com/you're welcome.
That's
Y-O-U-R.
That's correct.
Welcome.
Just like I learned in school.
Indeed.
I am like, thank you so much, Brett. In 2 weeks, we're going to have someone talking about alternatives to the legal system. And next week, we've got one of my absolute favorite leftists who's going to be here. I'm Michael Mouse. I will see you then. You are welcome.